Hey, David. Jeffrey Wells speaking. How are you, man?
Jeffrey, how are you? I guess I should ask, where should I send my check? I don't need a publicist.
Last time I was at that really great chat that you had with Todd McCarthy.
That was
a great moment.
Oh, you there?
I love that.
Well, those things are often odd because you kind of sit there and you go, you're kind of sort of dragged up like you actually have something left to say about this.
Yeah.
And you go, well, I hope you liked it, and
yeah.
I'd hate it if you didn't, but.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I thought it was,
how are things?
Very well. How are you? How are things going on January the, what is it, the 2nd today?
2nd, yes.
What did you do?
Okay.
What did you do for New Year's? Sit over your editing table working on Benjamin?
No, I didn't actually. I'm in Mexico, and then I get back to slave over a hot Final Cut Pro in a couple of days.
Yeah. Are you do you do Final Cut Pro yourself? Do you edit Benjamin Button on your
own? I'm actually sort of a computer philistine and inept at most of those things, but I do love it, I gotta say. And the guys that I work with who cut on it sort of swear by it.
Yeah.
It's got issues, but Avid has issues too.
Right. But one could the way you guys are doing it, you could have edited Zodiac on a Macintosh G4 if you had so chosen, right? I mean, the way you
Well, we cut on the Mac Pros and a huge RAID.
Right.
And so actually, yeah, if you come down, I'll show you exactly what we do because it's pretty interesting and it's very very not inexpensive, but it's. Its cost is what it should be,
right,
as opposed to what it's been like for cutting, digitally for the last 10 years. It's just been ridiculous.
Mm.
It should be cheaper. This technology should make it easier and cheaper and better.
Mm.
And it sort of finally has.
I heard secondhand from somebody who knows somebody who worked on Benjamin Button, and it sounds it is. Described as something that sounds very emotionally affecting. It's a very moving.
Well, good. I hope so.
Yeah.
It was for me. When I read the script, the first script, and then when I read the last script, the one they hired me to do. Yeah,
right.
Both times I was.
Right.
It was very moving.
Right. The only thing that I have not particularly been warm to about the whole thing is that twee little name that F. Scott Fitzgerald decided upon. It sounds like a fairy tale name.
Yeah, it is a bit. And we're sort of, trying to do everything we can to belie the fable nature of it, because certainly the movie doesn't embrace, except for one tiny little sort of visual
mm-hmm.
subplot
mm-hmm.
that is more about creating a world where something like this could happen. For the most part, the movie's played very straight, and it is. It's an odd title that, for all of its, it's odd to people who think that the title has equity, because I don't think you could fire a machine gun down Hollywood Boulevard and hit anybody who's ever heard of it.
Yeah.
But there are people who are like, well, we have to use the name because it's F. Scott Fitzgerald, and it's like you do realize that he wrote this, tossed this off in an afternoon to get some drinking money. So I don't know how sacred we have to play it, but in any case,
when did he actually write it? What year was it?
You know what? I think it's the I think it's the 30s. I think it's the late 30s or early 40s. And I actually think somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true, I haven't corroborated this, but that Paramount purchased it. Purchased the movie rights within weeks of it being published, and I think it was in Harper's or something like that, or
mm.
wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they've almost had. They've had the right to make this movie for something like 80 years, 70 years. You kind of go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Finally out of development hell.
When do you anticipate? Do you cut as you go along and shape it as you go along, or do you wait until it's all over? Or
how do you well, I'm a little bit, you know, type A. So I like to see stuff cut as we go because I like to I like to sort of be able to go, okay, well, we basically have that, but we can move on. Because I can't really stop thinking about something until I sort of see how the pieces go together, you know, not necessarily performance, but see if the staging works to support the idea of the scene,
right.
You know, because I think that's kind of the most important job, most important job that the director has is how do you stage it to kind of support the ideas. So I won't necessarily have to see the performance because I have a pretty good idea once we've wrapped that we've exhausted every conceivable possible angle on it. And then it's just a question of, and then, you know, like most things, it's a process of living with it. You know, you cut it and you think it's right. You think it's amazing the things that, you know, it's amazing things that screenings bring out, you know, things that people didn't understand because it seems so clear to you and or connections that they're making that would never have occurred to you. So, you know, it's kind of, you cut like four or five times. You do one pass, you sort of go through it and go, this is sort of what I think it is. And then you do another pass where you're just trying to excise fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you probably do a third pass where you try to cut it closer to the bone than you would be comfortable with because you got to show it to the people who paid for it. And then you go out and you start screening it, and then it's a whole other thing. You start over time.
Have you begun to show it to research audiences yet?
No.
Okay.
No, and we won't for many, many months because, you know, there's, you know, over 1,000 effect shots that have to be, you know, at least some stage near completion.
Right.
You know, right now you got people reacting to blue walls and blue clocks and trains that aren't there. And
I still don't understand, I still don't get why people sometimes say green screen and sometimes they say blue screen. I don't understand why.
They're two specific, completely different things, two completely different ways of working. And it really depends. Sometimes, you know, there are certain pipelines, you know, there are certain companies, visual effects companies, that are more prone to do blue screen, and there are other guys who really like green. And green was something that came out of the sort of the Ultimat era, the Ultimat, when Ultimat really became like the de facto composite methodology. And so it's just stayed. But for instance, like, you know, it's green screens need more light. It really depends on how you like to work. You know, green because it's normally it's lit a little bit brighter than a blue screen. Depending on the sensitivity of the cameras, you know, when you're shooting with a Viper, it's got a lot of blue sensitivity, so you can really underexpose blue screen so they don't, you don't get this much blue spill and contamination. You know, you can light them, you know, like two and a half stops under, so they're much easier for the Viper, or we found them to be easier to work with blue screen than green screen.
Right.
So it really depends. I mean, but they're both, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, somebody ordering equipment, they're both pretty much the same deal.
What is your opinion, as long as we're talking tech for a moment, of the red digital? What are they called? The red ones? The
red one, yeah. I think that he's brilliant, and I think that what Jim's trying to do is more than admirable. It's inevitable, and the notion of putting a piece of technology in the hands of anyone who wants, you know, I mean, the camera costs $25,000, you know, the lenses, you know, are another 18 or whatever. I mean, he's really democratizing, you know, movies.
Because they only cost $17,000, right?
What?
Because they only cost $17,000 to buy?
The body itself is like 25, and then, you know, with all the stuff on it, it's probably another 10, or, you know, with all the, you know, the side mount, you know, sidecar little viewing systems and all the stuff that comes with. with it, and the lenses are another like 20 or something. But for $50,000 or $60,000,
right,
you've got a camera that ostensibly, arguably, a 4K camera.
Right.
So you have, you know, vertical and horizontal. You have more resolution than you need, mm-hmm, for the most part.
Right.
And the only thing that they have yet to kind of get is the color space, because it has some issues, but they'll get there. You know, let's put it this way. The thinking behind it is, it's exactly what this technology should be.
Mm-hmm.
It should be affordable. Right. It should be fast and flexible, and you should be able to handhold it or mount it on a dolly or mount it to a Westcam.
Mm-hmm.
And it should, you know, you can take the flash drives out and suck them right into your MacBook Pro and look at what you did and see it at a resolution greater than anything you can get in any kind of video playback.
Mm-hmm.
So, how amazing.
You know, I'm just reading this Steven Spielberg chat with a profiler in Vanity Fair. It's a big piece about Indiana Jones number 4. And, you know, Spielberg, he's still very much a celluloid guy, but even a person who loves the texture of celluloid and doesn't like the idea of going into the digital realms where you and others have gone, how anybody with a visual eye could not fall in love with the amazing things that are being done with night shots. The opening shot of Zodiac, Mike Binder's work on Rain Over Me, the New York night shots, Michael Mann and Collateral, that is like turned the whole visual world upside down. It's been magnificent, I think.
It's purely a sensitivity issue, and for the most part, people have become attuned to the notion of seeing the night the way that it has been handled since since Blade Runner, which is, you know, it's a big source around a corner kind of lighting up the whole street. And this notion, you know, it's one of the things I always hate in movies when actors have flashlights in their hands, but you can see everything in the room.
Mm.
And you kind of go, why do they
have flashlights?
I can see everything. What, they can't see everything? You know, like that. It's that. So, so you know, I think one of the things about, you know, especially about the CCD and the way that it sort of captures that, it tends to look more like the way we see night, and that's an exciting thing, and a lot of people aren't sensitive to it. They just look at Collateral and they go, well, Miami Vice. You know, some of the boats, you know, cigarette boat stuff at night is just, you can see for miles, and you see for miles in the same way that you really see at night, which is you're just seeing point sources as they go off into the distance, but you also see that sort of atmospheric haze. You see the bounce of street lights onto marine layer, and there's a tone in the sky.
Mm.
And, you know, that was one of the things, like, in the original Close Encounters, the first one before they...
Yeah.
But the, you know, the way that you saw the nighttime in that movie, you know, the way that the spaceship sort of blotted out the moonlight and you could see a shadow of it at night, but you could just perceive this glow at the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
It was so beautiful. And I love the fact that you can actually kind of, I remember, you know, being, you know, specifically appreciative of that notion that the nighttime on a train crossing, at a, you know, one track, two lane train crossing in the middle of the night,
mm-hmm,
they looked like, you know, looked like one that I could see down the street.
I had a little dispute the other night. I would just I'll preface this by just saying that having seen the director's cut of Zodiac, I'm trying to remember, has it been twice or three times? I know it was, I think it's twice, because I saw it at the ArcLight screening, and I saw it on the DVD.
Okay.
And then I've seen the theatrical cut that came out last March, I believe three or four times.
Wow.
You come to appreciate that it's, although it nudges in the direction of, geez, I just forgot how long it is. Is it two, it's almost 45. Three now, right?
It's 2:45.
2:45. It is
went from 2:38 or 2:37:50 something to 2:45, so it's 7 or 8 minutes longer.
But it's so tightly focused and organized. Every scene delivers something key and essential to the overall puzzle, to the overall, you know, and it not for a second do you feel anything meandering or dragging at all.
Good.
And I was like, my mouth dropped when I talked to this 17-year-old stepdaughter of a girlfriend, my girlfriend, and she thought it was too long. I said, gee, really? Because that was kind of the point there, and but it was, you know, not entirely a point, but it was kind of the point, you know, I mean, that it would be that the obsessive...
It certainly goes to the point. I mean, the point being that you want... I didn't want to make a movie where we kind of went over the points one time and then gave you a lot of, like, scenes of, you know, a lot of montages of, mm-hmm. you know, Graysmith, you know, right. rubbing his temples and rubbing his eyes, so you had to see how weary he was becoming with this whole thing. I wanted you to actually kind of be weary of it, and I wanted it, and I want the audience to, and that's not for everybody, you know, there are people, you know, look, movies more and more are part of the same disposable culture as pop singles, you know, I mean, we don't live in a time where people listen to a whole album anymore, or collect albums, or think about, you know, collections of things. It's more of a, you know, it's a one-off society, and it's, you know, it's one and done in terms of, you know, musical artists, and, you know, and it's much more of that kind of a culture. So, you know, there's a great deal of that, you know, let's put it this way, that kind of thinking was pervasive
right.
in the testing of the movie. There were people who just felt it was too long. Mm. And yet, when you have to go back and cut it down to, you know, 2 hours and 5 minutes, you just realize what you would be losing. It would just end up being a pastiche of the case, and not really, you know, again, I'm not looking for answers as to who done it.
Yeah.
I'm looking to kind of illustrate, you know, what happened to this person over this period of time. What happened to Robert Graysmith? What happened to Dave Toschi? What happened to Bill Armstrong? What happened to Paul Avery when they crossed this case? And so, you know, there are ways to do it. You can do the telefilm version of it. You can mm-hmm. you could do the you know, the consolidation, but I felt ultimately that wasn't as it didn't seem as demanding as the case, as I felt the case was, and I felt that we needed to make a case for the case.
Yeah, you know, I almost apart from the obvious, which is that the obsessiveness of the movie reflects the obsessiveness of the characters, which is boilerplate yeah. reactions. I also kind of took it the first time I saw it as a kind of a metaphor for any creative problematic creative situation where you're trying to make an article work, you're trying to make it something
yeah.
work, and it, you know, it just won't work, and it's maddening. But you know,
you're trying to make sense of something.
Yeah.
And I think the thing ultimately, like, you know, when you ask, I mean, there are 10 different reasons for 10 different personality types as to why Zodiac is interesting 40 years later. And, you know, not the least of which is, okay, some people are going to say, it's really interesting that he used firearms and then he graduated to, you know, rope and knife, and then he filled outside of his safety zone by going to San Francisco, and so there are people who are going to be interested in that aspect of it. There are going to be other people that are interested in another aspect of it, and since we were kind of trying to do, we didn't want to use the Zodiac Killer as just a sort of narrative device
mm-hmm.
to you know, as a generic boogeyman. We wanted it to be about this specific case at this specific time in this specific city, and so those are the choices that we made, and we could have, you know, there's much more of a slasher movie to be made in there, but
yeah.
you know, we were calling upon the people who had, you know, suffered at the hands of this individual, and we were loath to tell them that, you know, the reason we're doing this is because it's going to be really scary, and mm-hmm. it's going to be a date movie, and it'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. That look. I know that you're renowned, respected, feared for your, asking some actors to do repeated, dozens of takes of a certain thing. But I thought that the expression that you got out of, oh boy, I'm not doing too well this morning. I've forgotten his name also. The actor who plays the prime suspect, with the ball.
He plays Arthur?
Yes.
He plays Lee Allen?
Yes. It just went away from me. I'm sorry. He was also in Things We Lost in the Fire. I love him.
John Carroll Lynch.
Yeah. John Carroll Lynch. That expression you got out of him at the hardware store at the very end of the film. That was
I wish I could say that I did. I mean, John Lynch is just the set's lit, the camera's where it's supposed to be, and you just watch. He's. Mm. I mean, we looked at so many people to play Lee Allen, and he was just hands down like the guy, and you just went.
Yeah.
I would love to take credit for, mm-hmm. An actor's performance, but that's not what I do. I allow for that and I help support that, but that's just, he's just fucking good.
Well, you gotta take credit for Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. I mean, he was...
No, I can't even take credit for that. But the editorial function of putting, recontextualizing, taking this moment where the guy's fed up and this moment, this moment from take 50 where the guy's exhausted and this moment from take 3 where he's, mm-hmm. he's excited to be there, right. Be able to use those two things in the same sentence, or cut away and cut back, that's what filmmaking's all about.
Yeah. Well,
and not to say, look, quite often we didn't shoot. I don't think we averaged more than 22 takes on the movie or whatever, 22 takes. But there are those times when you do stuff. Mm-hmm. I've done stuff, stunt things, and, it took 70 takes or whatever because you need something to, need the gun to, fly out of somebody's hand and slide across the floor and land in the foreground and be in focus. So when you do that stuff, it's going to take a while.
Well, those stories that Gyllenhaal was mentioning about the repeated takes, it reminded me of two other directors because he said, you just kept saying, let's do it again. And that reminded me of stories about William Wyler. He used to say the same thing, let's do it again, please. And Charlton Heston on The Big Country or whatever saying, look, Willie, what do you want from me? Just tell me, and just let's just do it again. And Kubrick also, let's do it again, please.
Look, I'm always capable of telling people what it is that I want. I've now recontextualized in my discussion about mm-hmm. let's do it again, but basically what I've said in the past and what I maintain today is that in the same way that directors have to have talented actors in order to be able to tell their stories,
right.
Actors need directors. They need somebody to sit there and they need somebody to watch their every facial twitch and respond to it in some sort of it's an editorial function. You're sitting there going, I either believe or I don't believe this behavior. I don't believe this behavior in this moment. And what I've said, and it's been, I have in the past, I'm loath ever to say to an actor, let's just try another one.
Yeah.
Because I think that they need to know where you're going.
Mm.
But I have said, with actors who don't seem to want to do their homework or they want to leave early because they want to go to the Golden Globes or whatever. You tend to kind of, if it gets to a point where somebody's being lazy or somebody's not paying attention,
mm-hmm.
The quickest way to make people pay attention is, or if they resent the direction that you're giving is don't give them any direction, because I've always found that actors, they want it, they need it. It's the reason that you're there. That's why I'm not embarrassed about shooting 20 takes if that's what it takes, because that's the reason that you're there.
Jake Gyllenhaal is going to be, I'm sure he is immensely proud already, obviously, but who's going to?
I hope so. I mean, he said that he is, and I take him at his word for it. I've never known him to be disingenuous. So, well, yeah, I think he is. I hope he is. I think.
You know, it's possible. Having been on sets, watched a little bit of that. When I see actors trying, kind of finding their way through the feelings, through the emotions that they want to deliver.
Yeah.
And it's a little rough, you know, and then it's a refining process, obviously.
Yeah.
And I've, I know that it, you can, I think that what he did, what Jake Gyllenhaal did, unfortunately, and I'm sorry to say this because I know Gavin Hood, but the rendition, I found it enormously irritating that his CIA, did you see the film?
I did, yeah.
He plays a CIA guy, and he's unhappy, he's not... He's disturbed with the torture that he sees of this poor Egyptian-born guy who's been, but he does nothing for so long, and to the point that I leaned over to a person that I was watching it with, and about two-thirds of the way through the film, I said, "Is he ever going to do anything about this, or do anything other than sit there and grimace?" And I said, there was something about that that I found enormously unsatisfying. And,
well, I think that, and that's kind of the area that I mean that's a structural issue, you know, for me is like, at what point does the character kind of lace up his bootstraps and, you know, roll up his sleeves? It's like, I don't know. It was an odd movie. I liked a lot of the, I thought some of the conceits were interesting. I thought it was unfortunate that it came down to a twist because you kind of go, you know, on an emotional level. I mean, he had a great cast, and I just think there are some structural issues, and that may be one of them for you as a moviegoer. Is like you sit there and you go, and that's a big, you know, that may be a conscious thing, and may have been a deliberate choice, and they may have been something that they struggled over. You know, knowing Jake, I can't imagine that he would say, you know, in this scene, I think I'll just sit here and grimace. He's not that guy. He's the guy who goes, well, don't you think I would just like overpower him and try to strangle him? It's like, no, I think you better wait. Now, you know, I always found the latter to be true.
Yeah.
But
your discussion. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say your discussion with Todd McCarthy last month. You talked about how one of the real delights of the director's cut is that black screen sequence where the viewer is taken through what is about 4 years through news.
It's just a music montage.
Yeah, plus a little Walter Cronkite thrown in there.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I wanted it to be 2 minutes long, but you know, that's just.
How long is it?
It's 45 seconds.
Kidding me. I thought that was longer than that. I really loved it. I didn't realize that. Oh.
It's only 45 seconds. It was as long as we could make it. And, you know, again, you know, we had a sort of, because it was a DVD version, there was a different negotiation for the music. But this was the music that, you know, again, we had a whole list of music that we were going to get for the two-minute version. And and I think we got down to, here's what you can afford. So we just took the first 45 seconds of the tracks that we wanted and made the montage out of that.
And yet what you said that night is that this pissed people off. They said after about 2 hours of the film, they just were not in the mood to watch a black screen for 45 seconds.
Well, it's a disconcerting thing for an audience because whether they want to admit it or not, and most of them, you know, most people say I come into a movie with an open mind, and that's just not true. Their mind is made up because of a number of different elements. You know, what are the actors that are in it? What is the track record of the actors? You know, are they in things that I normally like? Do they choose material that, you know, interests me? Does the trailer look like it's using that person or those persons to their best effect? Is the story something that I am interested in? There's all those things. And then they also have, on top of it, this kind of clock that they superimpose with that nobody really likes to admit. They all like to think that they're... But you know, there are a lot of filmmakers and a lot of producers and a lot of studios who live or die by that sort of internal clock, and the audience has it. And at, you know, 22 minutes to 32 minutes into the movie, they're like, have you established everyone and started to complicate this journey? You know, do I have a goal in mind? Do I know what this character wants? Do I have an idea of who they are and what they're about? And if you don't have that, you know, the audience starts to fidget. We have a Pavlovian response to the three-act structure. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can use this to great advantage. You know, I remember one of the things that I loved about Seven when I first read the script was I love the fact that John Doe gave himself up on page 95. And you go, wait a minute. You know, you're sitting in a theater and you watch all these people. All of a sudden, here he is, and he's covered with blood, and he's the guy. Yeah. And the audience literally starts scratching their heads. They start fidgeting in their seats. They're going, this movie could go on another hour. Mm-hmm. What's happening here? You know, this is not my father's Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
And some of that happened in the previous screenings of Zodiac, but the overwhelming unease that was created by, you know, going to black for 45 seconds, I think, sealed its fate as far as the...
You know, it's funny, there's also...
Theatrical release.
There's a long tradition.
People just...
Yeah.
At some point, they can't sit still anymore.
Mm. There's also a very long tradition that goes back to the days, particularly the days people who remember the old Perry Mason series. At the very end of each episode, William Hopper, who played one of the guys who worked for him, would always ask Perry, now what happened, Perry? I didn't quite follow, you know, and Perry would explain the whole thing, which was that same kind of scene that you have,
yeah,
when the cops review all their evidence one more last time, in a very tight fashion, to a guy on a speaker box about what they've got against Arthur Lee Allen. I said, this is pretty good. For those who weren't paying exact attention, here we go again, just to reveal it. You know, what's the problem? I was fascinated by it, and people didn't like that either.
No, they more than didn't like it. There were, again, you know, Perry Mason is a byproduct of the 60s. It comes out of, you know, and I think, again, you have to take into account a lot of things. And one is 2007, and people just have a different bit rate at which they consume information.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, you know, they didn't sign up. I mean, when they saw the trailer, they didn't sign up for a procedural.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at it in a different light. They thought it was something else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and to me, I like that scene because, again, I've shown it to friends whose, you know, parents were, you know, police officers in New York City who said, mm-hmm, I love that scene so much because that is so much what police work is about. Is like, how do I sell this internally? How do I make a case not only for my boss but for myself? How do I make sure when I'm called to testify that I've, you know, done everything that I can to be objective and to be,
right,
you know, and so to me it was, and the fact that it's delivered to a guy over a speakerphone, I love, because that's so much of what police work was about, and this is a technology that existed in a time where, you know, we go to great lengths to talk about what technologies don't exist in this day and age. And so I love the fact that they were trying to cut to the chase by doing this incredibly impersonal thing, and that you saw, you had this, you have them, you know, just the facts, ma'am. They run down just the facts. But you also see the sort of inner workings, you know, when Tony's asked, you know, what about the guns? And he kind of looks around and goes, oh, I don't have that piece of paper in front of me. And he kind of shoots a look over to Mark, and Mark kind of goes, yeah, well, we're going to include that, so don't worry about that. And you get the kind of, you know, how, you know, these guys stayed up late, and they worked this thing to the bone, and they did the best that they could, and now they're laying it out for the DA, and the DA's asking all the right questions, and there's more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, people did, you know, people did voice their disapproval. That would be a polite way of putting it.
Yeah. As you know, there really ought to be a sensibility in the executive levels of studios and where at least one person says, look, they may not have liked this, but look, this is the right way to go with this film. I mean, nobody ever seems to say that. If the research audience says, say no, end of story, end of discussion. And, you know, I don't think that if they had research audiences and research screenings in the days of, you know, let's say Irving Thalberg or Doris Sherry, I don't think they'll...
Oh, they did, yeah.
They did?
Oh, yeah, they tested movies in Pasadena, and they tested... But remember that it was, you know, part of... You know, there's oversimplification in terms of the statistical analysis of the data that they get, and then there's overspecification in terms of the questions that are asked. I mean, you know, the only realistic response, I mean, you know, movies are a completely subjective, you know, you have to have, it's a subjective thing, should this movie be made or not, and it's based on, you know, myriad number of factors, but when it gets right down to it, you cannot, if you could make movies by committee, they'd be doing it. There'd be no DGA, you know what I mean? If it was possible to do, the fact of the matter is, it's just not possible to do. I mean, movies are, it's completely subjective, collaborative art form. But remember that, you know, movie studios aren't in the business of making art. They're in the business of making commerce. And so they look at it and they go, if we have to suffer through the pretensions of this, you know.
You know, I've seen, I don't know how many police procedurals and police manhunt movies I've seen over the course of my movie-going life, but I don't remember ever hearing the phrase, I like this guy, as much as I do from your film. And I don't know if it's been in other films. I presume that you got it from, or the screenwriter got it from, you know, police who told them that that's a phrase that they use when they...
You mean when Armstrong says to Tosky?
Right. I like this
guy,
you know.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that because of this film, because I've never really heard that, or at least it hasn't sunk in.
Oh, no, it's all throughout. I mean, certainly, every time, you know, every time we went to interview Dave or when we talked to Bill Armstrong, I was like, yeah, but we really liked him, you know? We liked... It's like, yeah, it's such a great... It's such a great turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Like, that was, you know, yeah, you know, we had the whole, we went on a lot of guys, but a lot of them we didn't like. It was like, all right. Or we didn't like them for this. That's another thing I love that phrase.
Now,
we didn't like them for this.
No, the one final thing I wanted to ask you, just about the length, and I'll let it go,
sure.
Is that a person within the organization, I'll put it vaguely, saw, he claimed, a three-hour cut. And I thought, oh, great, you know, that's the point of this thing. I would love to see a three-hour cut or a three-hour and 15-minute cut, you know, something really Lawrence of Arabia length. And so I was a little surprised. He said he was much happier, or somewhat happier, significantly happier with that than he was with the theatrical, just privately between me and him.
No, say it again. I lost that last part.
Well, he just felt that he saw a three-hour version of Zodiac. And liked it significantly, somewhat, you know, there's no question he preferred that to the theatrical. And I was hoping that the, you know, the somewhat more, you know, obviously 3 hours being somewhat more obsessive than what it is now, we would see that. Was there a three-hour version that you liked that you just were persuaded to trim it down? Or
the first version that we did was 3 hours, and we did like it. But it was... You know, it was definitely, you know, it was not for the faint of heart, because it was, you know, it's the kind of thing it probably would have required an intermission. You know, again, it's not only the information that you're given, but it's the kind of information that you're given. It's one thing to be, you know, I think one of the reasons that, like, you know, JFK at its length seems to move so fast, it's because you have this incredibly affecting emotional piece of film in the Zapruder film that's sort of at the core and so so you have these things, these sort of there are more emotional stakes in it, and you know, everybody, you know, you see the footage of John saluting, and you see, I mean, you just, that's part of your upbringing. It's not, you know, those are your family, those are your home movies. Mm-hmm. And so it's a different thing than when you're running down something that's a case that maybe people, you know, for the most part, don't know anything about it. You know, I think for my money, the three-hour version, the three-hour version was never intended as a, yeah, we love this, let's go fight for this. Yeah. The 245 was the one that we were actually thought, this is the best distillation of the material that we had. We had, you know, a lot more, there was a lot more characterization, but there was not a lot more narrative, mm-hmm. and there was certainly a lot more redundancy.
You're mentioning a intermission. Just gave me an idea to go back in time and say, let's release Zodiac as a roadshow attraction with an intermission and an overture and an encore. But there's not really a lot of music.
I don't have any comment on that.
But that would have been something, you know. Would have looked.
Yeah, listen, this discussion has been had, and it was dismissed out of hand. Mm. But you know, look, there's a lot of kind of us and theming, you know, in terms of how people like to position this movie, because I think for people who really like this movie, they're kind of sitting there saying, well, you know, why aren't the people who paid for it as excited? Yeah. Well, they are, and they were, you know, this is not an inexpensive movie. So we didn't make this movie for $12 million, you know. Yeah. This movie cost $70 million, and it was, you know, 120 or 115 days of shooting, and it was, you know, it was a huge endeavor, and for the most part, you know, we were allowed to tell the story in the way that we felt was the best. Nobody said to me, you have to cut this last 7 minutes, you know. I just felt at the time that those were two scenes where we really, in preview screenings, and again, you're not preview screening in front of Perry Mason fans, or, you know what I mean, you're preview screening in front of 18-year-olds, you know, and you have to factor in, you have to factor that into the equation when you're deciding what stuff to cut. But it was pretty evident that, you know, if we were going to meet anybody, you know, halfway on the studio side, there were factions at the studio, at both studios, who felt the movie was right at the length that it was, and there were factions who felt it was too long, and there were factions, you know, there were people who loved the movie no matter what. But, you know, I think it is a, it's a, we, you know, we couldn't have been more supported in what we actually put out. And nobody, you know, nobody came in the middle of the night with scissors and made a 2-hour and 38-minute version. That was something that felt. I do think that the theatrical room is a different room than the home theater room. And I do think that the people are much more forgiving when it comes to those, you know, kind of first act, second act, you know, signposts, when they can pause, get up and get a Jolt Cola.
Yeah. Well, I'm very much looking. I just realized I haven't really had a chance to watch the listen to the commentary on the DVD, but I guess I'll do that soon because I haven't seen the screener that they sent out. But I wanted to compliment you or compliment whoever put together the seven directors, the seven DVD with all the extras. That was a significant turn in my feelings about Brad Pitt at that time, because he was you know the cutie that all the girls liked, and I was kind of and I really liked his performance, his angry performance in Seven. But what really sold me on the guy personally was listening to his commentary on the Seven DVD.
Yeah.
That was really, I said, boy, he's pretty intriguing fellow.
Yeah, he's really interesting, and he's you know, I remember when I you know, got the call from CAA saying, you know, Brad Pitt would really be interested in playing David Mills. Would you meet with him? And I was kind of like, the guy from Cal, because Propaganda Films was a company that I had, and we produced
California?
Yeah, California. Yeah. And so I knew, you know, I knew Dominic. I was great friends with Dominic Senna, and he told me how great he was and everything. And I hadn't seen the movie and everything. I said, sure, yeah, let me go see him. And I remember meeting him and just thinking, you know, there's something kind of there's like, this guy can say anything. He can say the most incredibly venal, you know, horrific, and it can come from a naive place, and you will just, you can forgive him almost anything. And that is, you know, his gift is that he gets involved in things that interest him, and the great thing is that he puts his money where his mouth is. He puts that interest. You know, you look at a movie like Jesse James, and you go, this is because this guy read this book and saw Chopper and said, are you kidding me? Like, what do I have to do to be involved? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And he is that kind of guy. He's not a, you know, he's not the movie star's dilettante.
Well, I think there's a final legacy for Zodiac, and I hope that people can at least look at the rundown on Movie City News of all the individual top 10 films that all the various critics and commentators have listed. And the rundown, when I last looked at it anyway, was that Zodiac was in the top 5. And yet the critics groups, for whatever reason, didn't, you know, give it a best picture of the year. But at least when I did a posting about this list maybe a week and a half ago, it was up there. It was like number 3, number 4, or something like that.
Well, you know what? All I can say is we got Jeff Wells. That's all I give a shit about.
Hey, by the way, if you were a talent and you were nominated, and
what?
If you were nominated, let's say, if you were a talent and you were invited to go to the Golden Globes because you were nominated, let's say, theoretically.
Don't start me.
Well, I'm just saying, if you were, I'm not talking about Zodiac particularly, but if you were, NBC is going to broadcast apparently regardless. And it's, you know, it's coming up.
Golden Globes this year?
Yes, that's what they said on Nikki Fink reported on Sunday, that they are going to broadcast. My understanding is that all talent wants to, they don't want to do it if it's broadcast. They'll do it privately, but they don't want to be part of a broadcast because that's, you know, is that pretty much how you understand things to be from the talent end?
You know what, my understanding is that, you know, people like it because they get to table hop with people that they've maybe never met.
Yeah.
But I don't know anyone who takes it that seriously.
Yeah.
So I think it's. I mean, look. I think it's. You know, it's a lovely night, and it's. But it's. But I still don't understand. I mean, it's hard for me to embrace something I just don't understand. I don't understand the Hollywood Foreign Press. I don't know what it means.
Well, what about the strike aspect, though? That's the thing.
What?
By attending, though, it's seen as kind of scabbing in a way by attending that.
Really?
Because they'll be picketing. They intend to be picketing, they say.
So. Well, in red tuxedos.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the whole. I mean, it's like saying, you know, let's have the top 10 Renaissance paintings. You know, you kind of go, oh, come on. Right. Trying to handicap movies in a year where they're supposed to be, you know, they're supposed to be disparate. They're supposed to be, you know, people's personal interests and stuff. How do you say one's better than the other?
Right.
Or, you know, I mean, it just seems a little, seems silly.
All right, David, I guess you have to go, but it was...
No, I'm okay, but if you have anything else you need.
Well, I naturally can't wait to see Benjamin Button when you start letting people see it. I guess maybe, what, sometime in the summer or something? I don't know.
Probably end of summer. We'll have enough stuff flat-sheeted that we'll be able to kind of go, well, this looks like the movie, you know, because obviously the last thing you want to do with a movie that's, you know, where most of the visual effects are the lead character. It's like you want to make sure you have that stuff in a seeable format. I'd love to show it to you.
Okay. Be well. Have a good week. And it's just been great talking.
All right, Jeffrey. Thank you very much.
Be well.
All right, man.
Take care.